This is the Breaker.News podcast for the week of January 29th, 2023. I'm Bob Mackin, publisher of the Breaker.News and host of the Breaker.News podcast. Welcome to edition number 275. The Breaker is your source for news, opinion, and analysis about British Columbia issues, institutions, and influencers. Later, I'll tell you how you can support The Breaker. On this edition, headlines from the Pacific Rim and the Pacific Northwest. I word a virtual Nanaimo bar to a difference maker. The big deal feature. History will be made January 31st in British Columbia. For the next 3 years, adults will not be arrested for possessing small amounts of hard drugs. Will decriminalization help reduce or increase the number of addicts and overdose victims? Hear from Dr. Julian Summers of the Simon Fraser University Center for Applied Research in Mental Health and Addiction. But first, is it just me? Is it just me, or does the BC NDP government deserve a yellow card for being secretive about the costs of the 2026 FIFA World Cup? Last year, the NDP finally fessed up. It would cost BC taxpayers $240 million to $260 million to subsidize the world's richest sports organization, which puts on the world's most profitable mega event. BC Play Stadium is one of the 16 venues for the tournament in Canada, US, and Mexico. On January 27th, an update. The cost is now $230 million for Vancouver City Hall. It turns out City Hall was supposed to be on the hook for $115 million, but nobody told the public until the NDP did on January 27th. There are more costs for BC Play Stadium, but the NDP won't say what those are. So it's very likely that the total bill is way more than $260 million. When an event like this comes along, the temptation to spend money and to renovate or expand existing infrastructure is irresistible for those who are addicted to other people's money. And they'll tell you it's a good use of your tax dollars. But is it really? Research by sports economist Victor Matheson, a professor at the College of the Holy Cross in Massachusetts, has consistently cautioned that mega event promoters and industry lobbyists rely on input-output modeling in order to attract or defend public subsidies. In one of Matheson's reports, he says that he found that many large sporting events simply supplant rather than supplement the regular tourist economy. Quote, in other words, the economic impact of a mega event may be large in a gross sense, but the net impact may be small. What do you think? Email Bob at thebreaker.news. This is the big deal feature on the Breaker.News podcast. Since British Columbia declared a public health emergency in April 2016, more than 10,000 people have died from toxic drug overdoses. An average of 5 people lose their lives daily. A majority are male between the ages of 30 and 59. Beginning January 31st, a 3-year exemption in British Columbia to federal drug laws. Adults will no longer be arrested for possessing 2.5 grams or less of hard drugs, such as heroin or cocaine. Advocates for safe supply and harm reduction say this doesn't go far enough. Advocates for recovery, who want to help people get off the drugs and live normal, healthy lives, say it's a move in the wrong direction. Joining me on the podcast is Simon Fraser University's Dr. Julian Summers, clinical psychologist with the Center for Applied Research in Mental Health and Addiction. Addicts are warehoused in aging downtown Eastside welfare hotels. Some are living in tent cities on Hastings Street or in Crab Park, generally third world conditions. Will this move towards decriminalization, even just for 3 years, have any positive impact on these situations?
It isn't poised to have a positive impact. The way that we've gone about it should, in my view, lead to some concerns about not only increased harms to people who are currently at risk, but the further distribution of risk through the population. And that is principally and straightforwardly related to the resulting expansion of the sale and distribution of drugs.
There's a story this week in Vancouver that people who have access to the vending machines, who have legitimate access to the vending machines, have been taking their supply and selling it to suburban teenagers who want to come in and dabble or test drugs.
We should be concerned about the many people who experience mental illnesses such as schizophrenia or bipolar disorder alongside their addictions, and who are made vulnerable to individuals who would have them get drugs from vending machines, hand them over. Similarly, among sex workers who are already very often under abusive, controlling relationships, vending machines become another source of potential income. And what the public supply of addictive drugs also represents to many people who are living in truly desperate circumstances is sometimes it is a source of the drugs that they're seeking, but in a great many times, it's a source of drugs that they can then sell in order to get things that they would very much prefer, other drugs that are not being dispensed, or other things that are necessities of life, food and the like. So this is placing emphasis on the role of substances when the addiction literature strongly demonstrates now over many years that the circumstances that people are living in, the ways that they're supported, are the main determinants of addiction. And so by this, the part that's most worrisome for me is the mindset behind this intervention is one held by people who are willing to ignore abject poverty, physical suffering associated with long-term homelessness and untreated mental illness, and prioritize a focus on the source of their drugs. It really is unique in the world. And the fact that we're being told that decriminalization will result in the decriminalization of marginalized drug users. That's what the text supporting this change reads as. It's about decriminalizing the people. We've published that among people who are experiencing opioid addiction in BC, 15,000 people, first of all, between them, they had been sentenced 70,000 times, five times on average per person. Possession as an offense accounted for 3.8% of their sentences. The idea that removing it as an offense is going to make a significant impact on their lives is demonstrably kind of strange. Most of their offenses involve forms of theft. I'm back to the ways in which they are forced to survive. And 10% are related to violent offenses. They are living in chaos and they are dealing with chaotic psychological experiences. So none of this should surprise us. What should surprise us is that our government is willing to ignore those things while trying to persuade the public that our tax dollars going toward an alternative supply, an additional supply of drugs to that population, is going to result in some net benefit when no place on earth has shown that that's been done.
What have you learned so far about the experiment in the state of Oregon where they've moved towards decriminalization?
The rule of thumb, Bob, in any case that we would care to look at, is that if we liberalize, the make more available, whether it's through our messaging and aimed at sort of changing perceptions, or whether it's through changes in the law, if we increase, or if it's through the supply, if we increase the supply or overall availability of drugs and don't do anything else, harms go up. So just that's a rule. And if we that should be unimpressive. Anybody should think, well, yeah, that's right, because there's that much more likelihood of an infant getting exposed to a drug. There's that much more likelihood of a person who has an allergic reaction trying that drug, being exposed to it in an innocent meaning way or a curiosity-based way. So there's all these probabilities multiply. what we should be taking much greater heart from is the evidence showing that if we provide people with offers of assistance to improve basic aspects of their well-being, decent housing, support for untreated mental illness, support regaining employment. Most of the people, we've worked with hundreds of people in long-term relationships, and they've been gracious and cooperative. They're participating in this research to make a difference for others. And 25% of them have been in parental foster care. These are the people deemed the, air quotes, hardest to house. The people who service providers in the downtown east side say they're worried about perishing. Some of them are barred from their own services because of the way that they present. But people in that group are willing, are highly motivated to pursue things like reunification with their kids. 23% have kids under age 18 that they're separated from. The wish to resume work, the wish to reintegrate, the wish to reestablish relationships is profound and highly motivating. And I should add that the comparison between what we're currently doing and what I'm describing has been done in randomized controlled trials in Vancouver, replicated in four other cities in Canada, four cities in France. This is a huge, huge open like secret. And both interventions cost about the same. It costs roughly $55,000 a year for to taxpayers to support people who have serious mental illnesses and addictions and who are living homeless in BC. That's mostly crisis-related costs, including things like hospital stays and stays in prison. So we can right the ship, dramatically reduce medical emergencies, dramatically reduce people's involvement in crime by providing them with something that they themselves say they very much want. And when we've studied it over multiple years, it is truly life-changing for people. They had given up on the idea of being reconnected with their kid for years. And now 3 years later, 2 years later, they're visiting and they're repairing their relationship, right? It's that kind of change. These are people on average in their late 30s, right? If you group everyone together. So there are decades of life ahead of them. And we are simply, when we presented the formal proposal, fully budgeted formal proposal to Minister Eby and Minister Malcolmson, proposing to implement this in BC, they a hard pass, silence. This was done, you know, in person, and just silence, awkward. We now know that what they were already committed to was a massive increase in spending to the SRO sector, with disproportionate amounts going to the agency run by the wife of the former CEO of BC Housing, right? So, but it wasn't a question of conflict that caught the attention of the auditors. It was the fact that the procurement process was shoddy, and there were no documents related to, well, what are we going to get for this, and how will we measure the outcome so we know we got what we were expecting? None of that. And meanwhile, they're taking a hard pass on a fully budgeted proposal to replicate in other parts of BC an intervention that had been shown to be highly cost-effective but socially very impactful with people in the downtown east side. So not only that, but when we reminded senior government officials that we had the ability through an interministry database that we had built over about 20 years in collaboration with the people that we've done research with, we've asked them for their consent to access these data, build this database, and over the years we've shown its utility, we proposed that that the government should consider using this database to evaluate with people's consent the effectiveness of our spending on services designed to help people with mental illnesses and addictions exit homelessness. Because through all of the research that we've done, we have benchmarks of what's achievable, what we can attain with people for certain increments of financial investment. So let's use that and compare outcomes, build on strengths, address areas where we think we could do better. And 1 week later, SFU gets a letter out of the blue. Thank you for the last 20 years. Please destroy the database immediately. And in writing, confirm that you've sanitized the drives. thanks again. You know, I'm summarizing, but there's no question. So the letter's online. There's no question that it was an immediate order of destruction. And then the government is trying to say that, oh, well, no, but this was foreseeable. No. There's the Ministry of Health, which is the lion's share of the data that we analyze, had already renewed the agreement. This, you know, bear in mind, like a 2 decades long process. If they had correspondence before demonstrating that this was foreseeable, it would be in the public domain. There is no correspondence to that effect at all. So out of the blue, all at once, after 20 years, and in the middle of what? A homelessness and addiction and untreated mental illness crisis? That's the point in time when you decide this is when we can safely go without information about exactly those things. So it defies credulity, and it's part of what makes me concerned about what's going to happen after January 31st among people most affected by our neglect.
My guest is Dr. Julian Summers of the Simon Fraser University Center for Applied Research in Mental Health and Addiction. I asked Dr. Summers about the different approaches to decriminalization of drugs in the state of Oregon and in Portugal, and whether a made-in-BC model based on recovery could include a reborn Riverview.
Wow, fabulous, Bob. The Portugal, any extrapolations from Portugal, I think, need to be first just framed in an acknowledgement that that we are extraordinarily different socially places. They are a place with deep roots and cultural roots, I mean, and we are perhaps the place on earth with the shallowest roots in its human population, excluding indigenous people, of course. But there are similarities. The similarities that I think are most compelling are the fact that they had a surge in the appearance of open air drug scenes across Portugal, and also a surge in the numbers of fatalities, drug related fatalities, leading Europe. And so they reached a point that is hopefully comparable to where we are, in the sense that there was a sufficient sense of crisis that they developed a national strategy that is a long read. It's available in English online. I recommend it to anyone who's interested. First third or so is addressing the law. If we make any changes, we are going to be impacting neighbors and international partners. So it's set out very thoughtfully. But the very first part is super clear. This is, they say, a reveille that must call all Portuguese citizens. It is principally about prevention. So even though they're dealing with fatalities and open-air drug scene, the document is framed around prevention. This is primarily about prevention. But to get to prevention use of drugs among young people, we're going to need to first go through address the challenges that we see all around us. And so they were not, as we are not, they were not making a big deal out of drug possession as an offense. The police were overwhelmed, as police are actually across Canada, in terms of the burden on them. Many first responders, actually all first responders, sorry, I should just hasten to add that there are very serious impacts that are not being acknowledged and well addressed among first responders. But the main things, back to Portugal, the main things that are credited with the dramatic reduction in open-air drug use and fatalities in Portugal are the resources that they put in place behind the scenes that enabled what they referred to throughout the document as social reintegration. That's their goal, social reintegration. So it kind of they're making a big assumption collectively, which happens to be actually well supported by evidence, but they're making the big assumption that if someone has serious drug problems, is out on their own, appears to also be mentally ill, they probably need a long-term plan that involves life in a community setting. So, but this is not actually a new set of ideas. When we deinstitutionalized, when we went from the Riverview of old to like so many places, to a community-based idea. We didn't, this was in the 60s and 70s. We didn't do it saying we were going to build the airplane while we were flying. We already had evidence that community-based care was superior for people. And all that's happened in the last 60 years is people like me and tons of others have added to that literature and shown how the preferences of individuals and what is in their long-term, the best we can do for them long-term with serious mental illnesses is maximize their ability to retain the relationships and activities in community settings that motivate them as people. Because when symptoms will change, and we're learning more and more that symptoms of very, very serious mental disorders as in terms of how we classify things are more far more changeable than we used to think. So this this model that implicates Riverview, that I think, you know, is worth considering, is acknowledging the history of Riverview and the center of excellence that it remains today, and for a much smaller number of people, but people who are in very, very severe crisis. What it doesn't have for its relatively small capacity is a proportionate discharge network of resources, places for people to go. And so if we were to use the information we have available to us and look at where are the concentrations of people who are experiencing serious mental illnesses and addictions, who are repeatedly involved with police, courts, and corrections, in and out of hospital, we've published this, like the actual rates in BC on a community basis, but if we had access to provincial data, it could be done on an updated way. But that already tells us where we should be locating services. What happens otherwise if people migrate? We've published this too. They move to places like the downtown east side. There's no part of the journey that appears to be positive for them. Everything gets worse. The number of days in hospital, number of admissions per year, number of convictions, all are going up, up, up. And at the end of that, they're homeless in the downtown east side. So we need to be decentralizing these services that have been shown to be effective. And one thing we can borrow from Portugal is pairing decriminalization with making drug possession an administrative offense, so that police have, and this is what happened in Portugal, police have the authority to intercede with individuals and on drug-related causes, they have the authority to take them to what are referred to as dissuasion commissions. Basically, it's a place that is there to try and make sure that the person doesn't wind up facing another police officer, right? And come back to the dissuasion commission. They're trying to do themselves out of a job. So for people that don't have a home, like many, it would be offering them home and support there. And the acceptance of support is important. But it can be done with everyone. Everyone needs support, and if we offer people what they most want and need, we can build an alliance, which is what has to happen. But Portugal also made very large scale use of therapeutic communities, over 60 therapeutic communities. So they had places for people to go where they could live, where they could be members of communities, where everyone is overcoming addictions, experiencing recovery from addictions. Often these are also related to some form of work and vocational training, with an eye toward being able to carry that forward once the individual leaves, because it's time limited. But with all of that capacity at the outset, right? So imagine where we are right now and how much BC doesn't have this kind of thing, right? So they had all of that. They didn't need until around 2018 to implement a single consumption site in Portugal. Consumption sites are mainly necessary in areas where we're going to, where society is prepared to accept for a sustained period of time that people will be using drugs and will be homeless or precariously housed. And then they need a consumption site. It's one of the main drivers of an assessment of need for a consumption site. But if your plan involves considering housing, a basic human right, and something that's in everybody's best interest anyway, I mean, for everyone to be housed, right? If your mindset is that, then we would procure with landlords in the private sector. So it's a big shift, doesn't involve BC housing in the same way. And we would secure units in a dispersed way throughout neighborhoods where there's a demonstrable need. And a site like Riverview, which I believe with in partnership with the Coquitlam Band and other key stakeholders there, I believe the plan has already been set to develop it as an ideal community, a model community. I think in that part of that model community should be reserving places for people who experience serious mental illnesses and need support. That hub of expertise that currently exists at Riverview can be the epicenter of not only the support that is provided to people living in the community on Riverview, but around the province. And also they can continue to serve the role that they currently play, which is the recipient of referrals from around the province, but now they'd be able to do it in a much more of a networked way and ensure that people are stepped up, stepped down in the level of intensity of support that they receive in a way that actually has steps. So there are things that we can do that have already been demonstrated. The cost effectiveness evidence is in. The blueprint remains there. I mean, it hasn't gone anywhere under the current government, but the plan wouldn't need to be radically revised in order to take into account more recent evidence. It's a relatively well-established model, and it's time for us to get around to implementing it.
So thanks again to Dr. Julian Summers for joining me on the Raker.News podcast.
Thanks, Bob. And yeah, you're right. Stay tuned.
For more information on Dr. Julian Summers and his research on mental health and addiction, go to summerspsych.com. That's SOMERSPSYCH.com. Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Around the Rim. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Rim. In the Taiwan news, former VP Chen Shih-chen takes over as Taiwan Premier. Tsai administration reshuffles cabinet for final 500 days in office. Premier Su Cheng-chang steps down after 4 years, making way for former Vice President Chen Shih-chen to return to the Executive Yuan as Premier. Chen said he was initially hesitant to take up the duty when contacted by Tsai over the Lunar New Year holiday, noting that he was hoping to conclude his academic research and other personal business. But upon reflection, he was swayed by a sense of duty towards a democratic Taiwan. Four priorities include continued COVID pandemic measures, strengthening the social safety net, infrastructure, and promotion of core industries. In Kyoto news, Dentsu officials admit to Tokyo Olympic test event bid rigging. A former operations executive of the Tokyo Olympics is suspected of playing a lead role in the rigging, along with several Dentsu staff, some of whom were seconded to work for the games. It is suspected that the rigging took place in connection with the 26 open bids held in 2018 for the rights to plan 56 test events. These were awarded to 9 companies, including Dentsu and fellow ad giant Hakuhodo Inc., as well as a consortium. In Hong Kong Free Press, chief editor of Hong Kong Magazine exclusive character reportedly missing in mainland China. Chen Jiming, chief editor of Hong Kong Magazine exclusive character, has reportedly been missing in mainland China for over 4 months. Ming Pao visited Chen's company's registered address in Hong Kong and was told by a man at the address, who called his mother, that they could not get in touch with Chen either. According to Germany-based poet Yang Lian, Chen has been arrested in China. The poet later told U.S.-backed RFA that Chen's Weibo, a Chinese social media platform, had stopped updating last September 21st. That's Around the Rim on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast.
Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Cascadia Calling. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Northwest.
In the Salem Statesman Review, scandal-plagued Portland Timbers and Thorns hire new CEO Heather Davis. Davis, 46, served as CEO on an interim basis after club owner Merritt Paulson stepped away last fall. She is among five women in charge of team operations in MLS. The club has been criticized following alleged misconduct by former Thorns coach Paul Riley. Missteps were detailed in a pair of investigations into coach abuse by the NWSL and the U.S. Soccer Federation. The Timbers also were questioned over the resigning of former player Andy Polo after an alleged domestic violence incident. In the Spokane Spokesman Review, the perfect plane for the Pacific Northwest. Horizon flies last turboprop plane out of Spokane on Thursday evening. Horizon, which was acquired by Alaska Airlines in 1986, estimates it's carried more than 50 million Pacific Northwest commuters on the plane since its introduction in January 2001. Thursday marked exactly 22 years since the Q400 came into service. Horizon is retiring the aircraft as part of a transition to a newer jet model, the E175, built by Brazilian airplane manufacturer Embraer. In the Victoria Times columnist, businessmen embroiled in Souk Harbor House legal battles to be deported. A deportation order was issued January 18th for Timothy Craig Durkin because of his involvement with a U.S. Ponzi scheme. On Tuesday, the BC Securities Commission announced Durkin had defrauded a would-be immigrant from China of $1 million by lying about ownership of the hotel. A decision on potential sanctions is scheduled for March 6th. That's Cascadia Calling on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast. It don't matter what color you are, 'cause love will conquer hate, so you won't stand alone, you won't stand alone. The Virtual Nanaimo Bar, brought to you by Spruce Hill Contracting. Every week we end the Breaker.News podcast on a tasty note by awarding the goodness of a virtual Nanaimo bar to people making a difference. A virtual version of the province's favorite dessert bar goes this week to
librarians. This is Family Literacy Week in BC, and a special thank you to the librarians for their role in literacy.
You can nominate someone for a virtual Nanaimo bar. Send me an email to bob@thebreaker.news. Spruce Hill Contracting, custom homes and renovations. Find more information at sprucehill.ca.
That's it for the Breaker.News podcast for the week of January 29th, 2023. I'm Bob Mackin. Thanks for joining me. Did you know that on the 29th of January in 1886, Carl Benz patented the first gasoline-powered automobile? Now you know. Send me your feedback. Send me your story ideas to bob@thebreaker.news. Bookmark thebreaker.news. You can also find us at thebreaker.ca. Sign up for the email newsletter and get updates to your inbox. For news as it happens, follow The Breaker News on Twitter and visit thebreaker.news on Facebook. You can support The Breaker for as little as $2 a month. For more information, go to patreon.com/thebreakernews. That's patreon.com/thebreakernews.
Until next week.